Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading news stories from Reuters for Thursday, April 2, 2026. Trump touts gains against Iran, but gives no timeline to end war. By Trevor Hunnicutt, Graham Slattery, and Steve Holland. Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump said in a televised speech on Wednesday night that the U.S. military had nearly accomplished its goals in Iran, but offered no clear timeline for ending the month-long war and vowed to bomb the country back into the Stone Ages. Facing a war-wary American public, sliding approval ratings, and pressure from some allies to outline his war aims in more precise and consistent terms, Trump said the U.S. had destroyed Iran's Navy and Air Force and crippled its ballistic missile and nuclear programs. But he declined to lay out a concrete plan to wind down the war, now in its fifth week, beyond saying that the U.S. would finish the job very fast. "We have all the cards," Trump said from the White House in his first primetime address since the U.S. and Israel launched the war on February 28. "They have none." He glossed over some major unresolved issues, such as the status of Iran's enriched uranium and access through the Strait of Hormuz, a conduit for global oil supplies which Iran has effectively closed. The strait, he said, would open naturally once the war ended. Trump's 19-minute address broke little new ground and offered scant reassurance to Americans and U.S. allies who are feeling increasing pain at the gas pump and growing impatience with the war. Stocks fell, the dollar firmed, and oil rose shortly after Trump's comments, reflecting widespread sentiment that the conflict is likely to drag on for some time. The president and his advisors have offered shifting explanations and timelines for the conflict, as well as what they will require from Iran for it to end. While portraying Iran as militarily neutered, Trump also said on Wednesday night that the U.S. would hit the nation hard for another 2 or 3 weeks. If the country's new leaders did not negotiate satisfactorily, he said, the U.S. would begin attacking the nation's electricity generation and oil infrastructure. As Trump spoke, air sirens blared across both Doha and Tel Aviv, illustrating how the Islamic Republic is still able to wreak havoc across the Middle East, despite taking heavy losses. "We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks," Trump said. "We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong." "In the meantime, discussions are ongoing," he added. "Yet if during this period of time no deal is made, we have our eyes on key targets." A day earlier, Trump told reporters Tehran did not have to make a deal as a prerequisite for the conflict to wind down. While the president on Wednesday briefly acknowledged growing concerns among Americans that the war is making gasoline unaffordable, he insisted that prices would soon go down and that the increases were mainly Iran's fault. He added that countries that get most of their oil supply from the Gulf region should take the lead in opening the strait. Britain, France, and other U.S. allies have said they are willing to help to keep the strait open, but only after hostilities have ceased. "They can do it easily," Trump said. "We will be helpful, but they should take the lead in protecting the oil that they so desperately depend on," he said. Trump has expressed anger that NATO allies have not offered to help open the strait, even threatening to withdraw from the 76-year-old alliance. While he had told Reuters earlier in the day that he would discuss the U.S. relationship with NATO in his speech, he did not mention the bloc. In a Reuters Ipsos survey conducted Friday through Sunday, 60% of voters said they disapproved of the war, while 35% approved. Some 66% of respondents said the U.S. should work to end its involvement in the war quickly, even if that meant not achieving the goals set out by the administration. Trump, meanwhile, has flirted with options both to escalate and de-escalate the conflict, and his next moves are unclear, even to some close advisors. His speech offered little additional clarity. Administration officials have floated a daring operation to physically seize Iran's remaining stockpiles of highly enriched uranium, as well as ground operations to seize strategic pieces of land, including parts of Iran's coastline and Karg Island, through which Iran exports the vast majority of its oil. Thousands of additional troops continue to sail toward the Gulf region, indicating the president wants to keep his military options open. Trump asked Americans to keep this conflict in perspective, noting prior wars in Iraq, Vietnam, and Korea had required far longer U.S. involvement. Britain says 40 countries discuss reopening Strait of Hormuz after Iran blockade. By Andrew McCaskill, John Irish, and Muvija M. London, Paris. About 40 countries are discussing joint action to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to stop Iran holding the global economy hostage, Britain said on Thursday, after U.S. President Donald Trump said securing the waterway was for others to resolve. British Foreign Minister Yvette Cooper said Iran's recklessness in blockading the waterway was hitting our global economic security, as she chaired the virtual meeting, which included France, Germany, Canada, the United Arab Emirates, and India. We have seen Iran hijack an international shipping route to hold the global economy hostage, Cooper said in opening remarks broadcast to the media before the rest of the meeting took place behind closed doors. Pardon me. The United States did not attend the talks, one official said. The discussions involving representatives of some 40 countries took place after Trump said on Wednesday evening that the strait could open naturally, and it was the responsibility of countries that rely on the waterway to ensure it was open. Iran has effectively shut down the key waterway, which carries about a fifth of the world's total oil consumption, in retaliation for U.S.-Israeli strikes which began in late February. Reopening it has become a priority for governments around the world as energy prices soar. European countries initially refused Trump's demand to send their navies to the area because of fears about being dragged into the conflict. But concerns about the impact of the rising cost of energy on the global economy have prompted them to try to form a coalition to see how they can defend their own interests. European diplomats said putting the coalition together was at an early stage, with Britain and France leading. Officials said the discussions on Thursday would focus on which countries were prepared to participate. France's Armed Forces spokesperson Guillaume Vernet told a news conference on Thursday that the process would be multi-phased and could not happen until hostilities had calmed or ended. The key focus of the talks would be how to ensure shipowners could feel confident enough for vessels to resume traveling through the area and to bring down insurance premiums. There would also eventually need to be coordination with Iran to ensure that there will be security guarantees for ships, Vernet said, something that is unlikely for now. Talks had also started on what military assets could be provided, he said. We will need to assemble a sufficient number of vessels and have coordination capabilities in the air, at sea, as well as the ability to share intelligence, he said. Britain said it would host a meeting of military planners for talks next week. Trump said on Wednesday evening that other countries that use the Strait of Hormuz should build up some delayed courage and just grab it. Just take it, protect it, use it for yourselves, he said. But France's President Emmanuel Macron, speaking in South Korea on Thursday, said seizing the strait militarily was an unrealistic option. It would take an indefinite amount of time, and it would expose all those who venture through this strait to coastal risks from the Revolutionary Guards as well as ballistic missiles, he said. My apologies for that long pause. I had some technical difficulties. Russia woos students for its drone forces in Ukraine with large financial packages. By Andrew Osborne. Moscow. students across Russia are being offered large financial incentives to join drone units fighting in Ukraine as operators and engineers, while companies in Russia's central Ryazan region have been given quotas to sign up workers for the army, documents show. The recruitment effort, which comes as Russian forces continue to grind forwards on the battlefield in Ukraine, and as U.S.-brokered peace talks are on ice due to the Iran war, suggests Moscow is diversifying its push to replenish its army's ranks in what is the fifth year of its war. But it is not part of a general mobilization drive, something the Kremlin has said this week was not on the agenda. Nor, say top officials, is Russia running short of recruits despite Ukrainian claims, dismissed by Moscow, that Kyiv is eliminating Russian troops faster than they can be recruited. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council, told state media on Friday that Russia's recruitment system, which offers substantial financial packages to volunteers, continues to deliver. More than 400,000 people had signed up last year, and over 80,000 so far this year, he said. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Thursday he had not seen official documents concerning student recruitment and corporate recruitment quotas in Ryazan, but confirmed that students were being encouraged to join Russia's drone forces, a new division of the armed forces set up at the end of last year at the behest of President Vladimir Putin. The recruitment officer applies equally, The recruitment offer applies equally to everyone, workers, students, and the unemployed, Peskov told reporters. This is a completely open offer, an offer to join a new type of unit, he said. Russia's move to target students, a process critics say has sometimes been accompanied by undue pressure, suggests that Moscow is keen to pour more skilled human resources into its drone forces, which, like those of Ukraine, play an increasingly pivotal role in what has long become a war of attrition. Drone operators from both sides typically work some distance from the front line, but are regarded as high-value targets who are hunted down and killed if their positions are revealed. The Far Eastern Federal University in Vladivostok is promising students who sign up for a minimum of 1 year extendable academic leave and a guaranteed exemption from any education fees on their return, plus free accommodation and grants. It is also pledging to cover the costs of any military equipment and weaponry needed. That is on top of what, by local standards, is a substantial financial package, a first-year salary from 5.5 million rubles, $68,433, a one-off payment of 2.5 million rubles after free training, a monthly allowance of 240,000 rubles, and a one-off payment of 200,000 rubles from the university. This is not only an opportunity to prove yourself, but also a unique platform for social and career advancement, backed by unprecedented support measures, the university said in a document published on March 19. The Moscow State University of Civil Engineering is offering similar incentives, telling students in a statement on its website that they have the chance to become drone operators, engineers, or technical specialists. The Russian State Hydrometeorological University in St. Petersburg is also encouraging its students to sign up. Its offer, published on its website, shows a drone operator promising payments from 7 million rubles, $87,000 per year. There have been unconfirmed media reports that universities have been given recruitment quotas to meet, and leaks suggesting that students, especially those who have failed exams or are indebted, have sometimes faced undue pressure to sign up, such as being threatened with expulsion if they do not. Reuters was unable to independently confirm that, and the Russian Defense Ministry and universities say signing up is entirely voluntary. The drive to woo students coincides with a new billboard recruitment campaign, which shows a young drone operator with glowing eyes in high-tech glasses under the title, The New Indispensables. Meanwhile, Pavel Malkov, the governor of the Ryazan region, which has a population of over 1 million, has ordered private and public companies to set recruitment quotas for workers to sign contracts with the Army. His orders, contained in a decree which was published on a government website and publicized by state media, said that companies with up to 300 workers should provide 2 Army recruits, companies with up to 500 employees, 3 recruits, and companies with more than 500 workers, 5 recruits. The decree did not say what punishment, if any, companies would face if they failed to meet the quotas. Indonesia earthquake damages buildings, but tsunami alerts have been lifted. By Reuters. Jakarta. A magnitude 7.6 earthquake struck in Indonesia's northern Molucca Sea on Thursday, killing one person, damaging buildings, and triggering tsunami waves, authorities and witnesses said, though monitoring agencies said the likelihood of further casualties was low. Indonesia's meteorology agency, BMKG, said there were tsunami waves reported in 5 locations, the highest at 0.75 meters, 2.46 feet, in North Minahasa, in North Sulawesi, and about 50 aftershocks were monitored, the largest at a magnitude of 5.8. BMK Chief Tuku Faisal Fatani initially said modeling indicated there was tsunami potential for waves of 0.5 meters to 3 meters, 1.5 feet to 9.8 feet high, but the agency lifted its tsunami warning later on Thursday morning. The epicenter of Thursday's quake was roughly 580 kilometers, 360 miles, south of the Philippine coast, and 1,000 kilometers, 620 miles, from Malaysia's Sabah, and struck at a depth of 35 kilometers, 22 miles. The United States Geological Survey said 9 other quakes with a magnitude of 7 or more have occurred within 250 kilometers of the Thursday event over the last 50 years, but had not caused extensive damage. Though the epicenter is within 150 kilometers, 93 miles, of densely populated islands like Tamate and Sulawesi, USGS said there was a low likelihood of further casualties, and economic damage was also expected to be limited. Indonesia's National Disaster Agency urged caution. Although relatively small, this situation still requires vigilance due to the potential for aftershocks, it said in a statement. It said initial reports were of minor to moderate damage to several houses and a church, and a fuller assessment was underway. It said tremors from the initial quake were felt strongly for 10 to 20 seconds in Bitung City and Tamate City, and subsequent aftershocks were located in the sea, urging the public to remain calm and follow guidance until authorities could declare the situation was safe. Abdul Muhari, a spokesperson for Indonesia's disaster agency, urged citizens to stay away from damaged buildings, warning that there were still aftershocks. Indonesia's Metro TV showed video footage of damaged buildings, and a Manado resident told Reuters people ran out of their houses in panic. There was no visible damage in her neighborhood, but items fell off shelves and power had been cut, the resident said. The Philippines seismology agency, FIVOLX, said there was no destructive tsunami threat to the country based on its latest data, while Malaysia's meteorological department said there was no immediate tsunami threat to the country, but it was monitoring developments. The Pacific Tsunami Warning Center warned of the risk of waves of less than 0.3 meters, 1 foot, over tide levels for the coasts of Guam, Japan, Malaysia, Papua New Guinea, the Philippines, and Taiwan. Japan may see waves of up to 0.2 meters, 8 inches, but no damage is expected, the Japan Meteorological Agency said, as it warned a tsunami could occur in the Pacific. Ahead of Greek social media ban, parents desperate to separate children from phones. By Lefteris Papadimas and Rene Maltezou. Athens. Greek mother Georgia Efstatu has tried everything to loosen the grip that social media has on her 14-year-old son. Heart-to-heart talks, internet-free time, confiscating his phone. Arguments flare as she fights the allure of his screen and its videos and messages. Now, Efstatu may be getting the help she desperately wants. In the coming days, the Greek government is expected to announce a social media ban for children under 15, joining the growing ranks of nations seeking to shield young children from addiction and online abuse. "Ban them, shut them down, we've reached our limits, we parents need help," said Efstatu, 43, holding her son's mobile phone in her living room in Athens. Efstatu isn't alone. An opinion poll by ALCO, published in February, showed about 80% of those surveyed approved of a ban. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis's government has already outlawed mobile phones in schools and set up parental control platforms to limit teenagers' screen time. The government has declined comment on the ban or when and how it will be implemented. Reuters reported on the plan in February, and sources said a formal announcement is pending. Last month, Mitsotakis told a Greek-Australian newspaper that Greece will move in a similar direction to that of Australia, where social media companies were ordered in December to keep out users under 16 or face fines. As in countries across the world, Greece faces a reckoning with social media sites such as Meta's Instagram, TikTok, and online gaming platforms. At the EU-funded Greek Safer Internet Center in Athens, calls to a helpline which offers support to child victims of cyberbullying more than doubled between 2024 and 2025, said George Kormas, who runs the helpline. Other complaints include blackmail of minors, misinformation, and hate speech. According to the helpline's data, 75% of children using social media in Greece are of primary school age. "This undoubtedly worries us because they cannot handle social media or protect themselves," he said. The head of the National Organization for the Prevention and Treatment of Addictions, Athanasios Theokaras, said roughly 48% of teenagers have felt the negative impact of social media. "Clearly, the ban has the potential to provide a significant degree of protection," he said. Meanwhile, parents who spoke to Reuters fear they have lost control of what their children do online or express concern that kids will find a way around the ban. Some prefer no government intervention at all. "I prefer a different approach, limiting mobile phone use within the family," said Dimitris, 44, "but where that's not possible, perhaps a ban would work as the extreme remedy." His 14-year-old daughter, Catherine, says most teenagers her age have never known a world without social media. "It's the way we learn since we were born," she told Reuters, before playing basketball with her father near the Acropolis. "I can control it, but then again, I usually get carried away." At Village Pub in Orban's heartland, Hungary's vote plays out over pints. By Christina Tan and Christina Fenyo. Malinka, Hungary. Sándor Toth has been running his pub in a small village in the hilly northeast of Hungary for 43 years, witnessing the collapse of communism and, since 2010, four victories by the lawmaker for Viktor Orban's Fidesz party in his constituency. Since last year, his pub has been awarded 3 million forints, $9,000, in grants from Orban's pub program, which allowed him to install new windows and air conditioning. Hundreds of pubs got the free state grants under the government slogan that they are the soul of the villages. Poorer rural areas have been a stronghold for the ruling nationalist, socially conservative Fidesz, partly due to community work projects that depend on funding from Fidesz-controlled local authorities. In many places, Fidesz is synonymous with the state, which provides money and jobs. Fidesz allies also control large parts of Hungary's private media, while the public media largely serves as a government mouthpiece. Orbán's government denies undermining press freedom. Orbán's nationalist narrative promoting Hungarian interests against the European Union or rejecting funding for war-torn Ukraine has resonated with the older and more conservative demographic in rural areas. With the veteran leader facing his toughest re-election bid in 16 years in an election on April 12, rural Hungary has again become the most important battleground, with 88 of the 106 constituencies located in the countryside. In Parliament, 106 of the 199 seats are won from constituencies. As he pulls a pint of sour cherry beer at 800 forints, $2.38 a pint, less than half of Budapest prices, Toth says he believes most people in his village of Malinka, where about 450 people live, would support Orbán again. "I believe generally here people vote for Fidesz as they help pensioners and also young people," he says, adding, "not all parties would have granted pubs the money he received." With 1980s memorabilia on the walls and a 1990s jukebox, Toth's Sani pub has become the center of town in Malinka, in a strategic location next to the soccer field and with a license to sell tobacco. "The village, our direct connection to nature, the land, these are essential parts of human life that must be preserved," Orbán said in a campaign speech in January. In the constituency that includes Malinka and 81 other villages, Fidesz candidate Zoltán Demeter won the 2022 election with more than 54% of the vote. This time, he faces a tougher challenge. Orbán's challenger is the center-right Tisza Party, launched in 2024 and led by Péter Magyar, who was once inspired by Orbán but now wants to unseat him as prime minister. Opinion polls show Tisza with an overall lead nationally, though many voters remain undecided. According to an opinion poll by 21 Research Institute conducted in early March, Tisza has a strong lead over Fidesz in all age groups under 50. Fidesz had a clear lead among voters over 65. Tisza has stepped up campaigning in the countryside, hoping to combat a 16-year legacy of opposition parties largely failing to offer rural areas a viable alternative to Fidesz. Magyar has been touring towns and villages for 2 years, promising jobs, roads, and better healthcare services. In the run-up to Election Day, he has held campaign events in 5 to 6 different places a day nationwide. The 21 Research Institute poll showed Fidesz had a lead of 37% versus 33% for Tisza in villages. The mood in small rural towns and villages is different from earlier elections, when the public quickly lost interest at events. Now they turn up and listen to what Magyar has to say, Eurasia Group said in a note, predicting that Magyar was making headway in rural constituencies. Tisza's local candidate and volunteers go door to door in the villages in Toth's constituency, trying to win over voters by offering support for renovating roads and improving healthcare services and schools. "This is key. I think this was missing badly from previous campaigns, that we must go to each street," said Tisza candidate Zaba Hatala Kroos. "We can promise to support local small and medium-sized businesses, rebuild roads. I've been doing fieldwork here for almost 2 years, and I got to know these 82 villages, and I have really put my heart into this." Serbian president invites parties for talks as anti-government protests continue, by Reuters. Belgrade. Serbia's president Aleksandar Vučić will begin talks on Friday as part of what he has billed as a way to lift the country out of a political crisis, but which critics have rejected as pointless negotiations ahead of an early election. Vučić, a populist, faces pressure from an anti-government and anti-corruption protest movement that started in December 2024 after 16 people died in the collapse of a concrete awning at a railway station in the northern city of Novi Sad. Protesters' demands include an early parliamentary election, ahead of when it is due in December 2027. On Tuesday, following a violent protest in Belgrade, Vučić, whose second and final five-year term also expires in 2027, floated the idea of a vote this summer or later in the year. When he has referred to the aim for society-wide dialogue over the past year, he has said he wants to invite all parliamentary parties and students, among others. Vučić's office said he would on Friday meet representatives from the pro-Russian Movement of Socialists and leaders of the Bosniak and Hungarian National Minorities, Party of Justice and Reconciliation, and the Party of Vojvodina Hungarians, parties supporting his ruling Serbian Progressive Party, SNS. Ana Brnabić, the parliamentary speaker from the SNS ranks, told state RTS TV the topics would be the calls for an early parliamentary election and Serbia's relationship with the European Union. Savo Manojovic, leader of the Move Change movement, which takes part in the protests, said talks with Vučić would be pointless. There should be no negotiations about free elections, autonomous university, independent judiciary, he said. The opposition Green Left Front said it would not take part, saying, "We will continue to respond to Vučić only with an unsparing struggle against his criminal regime on all fronts." Before it joins the EU, Serbia must reform the judiciary, curb corruption, mend ties with neighboring Kosovo, and align foreign policies with those of the bloc. Belgrade balances its pro-Western bid and ties with China and Russia. Humpback whale Timmy struggles to escape shallow waters off Germany, by Reuters. Berlin. A young humpback whale named Timmy, by rescuers, was struggling to find its way out of shallow bays off the Baltic coast of Germany on Sunday morning after a week-long ordeal that has put its survival in doubt. The plight of Timmy, who is thought to measure 12 to 15 meters in length, shows the difficulty of freeing such creatures given their size, with rescuers using dredging equipment and boats to guide the whale back onto a long route to the Atlantic. After days of efforts to free the animal, rescuers are now hoping the whale will manage to make it out on its own. "The whale is quite weak. We're still hopeful that it will pull through," Daniela von Schapper, a marine expert at Greenpeace, told Reuters. The whale, whose gender has not been established, was named after Timmendorfer Strand, the white sandy beach on Germany's resort-filled Baltic coastline, where it was first spotted on a nearby sandbank on Monday. Repeated rescue attempts have failed since, with Greenpeace and its partners documenting an animal in severe stress with skin irritation and fishing gear entangled in its mouth. There were brief glimmers of hope over the weekend when the whale managed to free itself twice before running into difficulty again. Humpback whales are not native to the Baltic Sea. While uncommon, large whales are spotted in the region every couple of years, according to von Schapper. Conservationists say disrupted migration routes and human influence play a role in whale strandings around the world, though animals can also lose their way while searching for food. Some of them find their way out again, others unfortunately do not, von Schapper said. Paris police tighten security after foiled bomb attack, by Mathieu Roussiman. Paris. France has increased security at sensitive sites across Paris after a foiled bomb attack on Bank of America's offices that prompted some other U.S. banks in France and Germany to allow their staff to work remotely on Thursday. Citing an elevated terrorist threat, Paris police said they had reinforced protection around religious and cultural sites, diplomatic premises, and some economic venues, as well as across the wider metropolitan region. Four suspects, including three teenagers and an adult, have been placed under formal investigation for their alleged role in last week's attempted attack, French anti-terrorism prosecutors said on Wednesday. The adult is suspected of recruiting the teens and paying them between 500 and 1,000 euros, $580 to $1,160, to plant and film themselves placing the bomb. All four, who are in pretrial detention, deny terrorist intent. Their improvised explosive device, a 5-liter petrol can taped to a large pyrotechnic charge, was the most powerful of its kind identified in France to date, prosecutors said. The police have said they suspect the foiled plot is linked to HAYI, a pro-Iranian group that had posted a video naming Bank of America's Paris headquarters. However, prosecutors say the link is yet to be confirmed. Goldman Sachs told its Paris staff they could work remotely on Thursday, a source familiar with the matter said, while Citigroup staff in Paris and Frankfurt are also working remotely. It is a precautionary measure, Citi said in an emailed statement to Reuters. French President Emmanuel Macron commended the authorities for thwarting the scheme. I want to stress that we are highly vigilant on all these matters, and also to reassure those who may be targeted in France and elsewhere, as several other European countries have faced similar types of attempted attacks, he said, while on a trip to South Korea. Officials are concerned the conflict with Iran, which began with U.S. and Israeli attacks at the end of February, could inspire attacks in France. The national psyche has been scarred by Islamist militant attacks in 2015 that killed 130 people in November and 17 in January, prompting tougher security laws. Britain hits renewable power record in 2025, but fossil fuel use also up. By Reuters. London. Renewable power, such as wind and solar, provided a record 52.5% of Britain's electricity generation in 2025, government data showed on Thursday, but fossil fuel use also rose. Britain has a target to largely decarbonize its electricity sector by 2030, which will require a huge scale-up of renewable power. Renewable generation in 2025 reached a record 152.5 terawatt-hours, up 5.7% from 2024, driven by record output from offshore wind, solar, and bioenergy, data from the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero showed. Gas power generation rose by 4.7% and was the largest single source of electricity supplies, providing 31.5% of total generation. Offshore wind generation increased by 6.6% in 2025 as more capacity was added. Higher gas and renewables plugged a drop in nuclear generation, which fell by 12% to 35.9 TWH, with older plants decommissioned and increased outages across the aging fleet. Last year was the first in more than 140 years with no coal-fired power generation in the country after the last plant closed in 2024. Net electricity imports fell 11% from 2024's record high to 29.7 TWH. Total electricity demand increased slightly, up 0.2% to 320.2 TWH. Separately, the government said on Thursday that greenhouse gas emissions fell 2% in Britain in 2025, with emissions from the electricity sector down 1%. U.S. Congress to pass bills to fully fund Homeland Security, Republican leaders say. By Richard Cowan and Nolan D. McCaskill. Washington. Republican leaders in the U.S. Congress on Wednesday said they will take a two-pronged approach to ending the legislative deadlock over Department of Homeland Security funding by passing a bill soon to end the partial agency shutdown and attempting to follow up with another bill providing money for the remainder of the Trump administration. Congress will fully reopen the department, make sure all federal workers are paid, and specifically fund immigration enforcement and border security for the next 3 years. Senate Majority Leader John Thune and House of Representatives Speaker Mike Johnson said in a joint statement. Congress is in the midst of a two-week recess. But the next legislative action is expected to come early on Thursday, when the Republican-controlled Senate is scheduled to hold a pro forma session that usually operates for a very short period of time and with few senators in the chamber. The goal, according to a source with knowledge of the plan, is to again approve a DHS funding bill that the Senate unanimously passed last week, but the Republican-controlled House rejected. That bill would fund the DHS to September 30, the end of this fiscal year. Instead of signing off on the bipartisan Senate bill, the House passed a 60-day extension of DHS funding, a measure that Democrats had repeatedly rejected. Those dueling bills underscored the deep divisions among conservatives in both chambers, in addition to significant disagreements between Republicans and Democrats. The longer-term funding could take weeks, if not months, to compose, and likely would be through a process that excludes Democrats. It is too early to know whether the bill Republicans eventually draft will clear strict procedural hurdles. Even with this latest development, Republicans and Democrats were still blaming each other for the 6 weeks in which some DHS workers received no paychecks, and airports were mobbed with passengers struggling to get through long security lines. That was because some Transportation Security Administration agents either called in sick or quit their jobs. For days, Republican divisions derailed a bipartisan agreement, making American families pay the price for their dysfunction, Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said in a statement. The standoff in Congress began when Congress insisted, Democrats insisted on new controls governing a controversial migrant deportation program. Democrats wanted the spending legislation to prohibit immigration agents from concealing their identities and entering homes without a judicial warrant, among other restrictions. President Donald Trump, who did not take a clear public stance on last week's congressional battle, said on Wednesday that he was working with Johnson and Thune to fund immigration agents through a process that bypasses the Senate filibuster. We are going to work as fast and as focused as possible to replenish funding for our border and ICE agents, Trump said in a post on Truth Social. I am asking that the bill be on my desk no later than June 1st, he said. On birthright citizenship, Trump's restrictive immigration agenda hits a rare roadblock. By Andrew Chung and John Cruzell. Washington. President Donald Trump took the short trip from the White House to the U.S. Supreme Court with his signature priority of cracking down on immigration largely intact, given repeated interventions by the nation's highest judicial body in his favor. By the time he left, his luck may have run out. With Trump looking on from the public section of the courtroom, a historic first for a sitting president, most of the nine justices seemed unwilling on Wednesday to let him proceed with what may be the most audacious piece of his restrictive immigration agenda. At issue during the arguments was his executive order that would deny birthright citizenship to hundreds of thousands of babies born each year on U.S. soil. The members of the court, led for more than two decades by conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, signaled that the administration's arguments backing Trump's effort are legally invalid and inherently impractical. I do not think that Chief Justice Roberts wants to go down in history as presiding over a court that ended birthright citizenship, said Kevin Johnson, an immigration law expert at the University of California, Davis. The court, whose 6-3 conservative majority includes three justices appointed by Trump, heard the administration's appeal of a lower court's decision that blocked his directive. The lower court found Trump's order to be inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment, which long has been interpreted as granting citizenship to virtually anyone born on U.S. soil, with some narrow exceptions, including the children of foreign diplomats or members of an enemy occupying force. The 14th Amendment's provision at issue, called the Citizenship Clause, states, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States." Johnson said the court will likely be swayed by the plain language of the Citizenship Clause and the long, unbroken history of birthright citizenship. The questions of the justices touched on some possible cracks in the rule, but it remains intact, Johnson said. Roberts labeled as quirky the administration's argument that the 14th Amendment's phrase, "subject to the jurisdiction thereof," limits large categories of immigrants. The Chief Justice also appeared to dismiss a contention by U.S. Solicitor General D. John Sauer, defending Trump's order, that the risk of birth tourism, by which foreigners travel to the United States to give birth and secure citizenship for their children, is a reason why the long-standing interpretation of the citizenship provision is wrong. "We're in a new world now," Sauer said. 8 billion people are one plane ride away from having a child who's a U.S. citizen. "Well, it's a new world," Roberts replied. "It's the same Constitution." Not all the justices appeared to doubt Trump's policy, however. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito, for instance, seemed receptive to the administration's argument that birthright citizenship should be extended only to those with lawful domicile in the U.S., which lawyers for the administration define as lawful permanent residence within a nation with intent to remain. Trump's order had instructed U.S. agencies not to recognize the citizenship of children born in the United States if neither parent is an American citizen or legal permanent resident, also called a green card holder. Trump issued it on his first day back in office in January 2025, and it stood as a key part of his sweeping agenda to restrict both legal and illegal immigration. Both it and many other immigration-related measures his administration has taken, in particular to pursue a policy of mass deportation, were quickly challenged in court. The trajectory of Wednesday's arguments contrasted with a number of actions the Supreme Court has taken that have allowed Trump to implement many of these policies while the legal challenges play out. For instance, the court has let Trump end humanitarian protections for migrants, deport them to countries where they have no ties, and carry out aggressive immigration raids that can target individuals based on their race or language. In certain cases, however, the justices have ruled that the administration must treat migrants fairly, as required under the Constitution's promise of due process. Elora Mukherjee, director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Columbia University's Law School in New York, said it is not surprising that the court would rule against Trump on birthright citizenship, despite siding with him on other immigration issues. "Birthright citizenship is core to our identity as a nation," Mukherjee said. "It is unlike any of the other contexts, which are not central to how all Americans live their lives and are not central to how we as a nation for generations have viewed ourselves." George Mason University law professor Ilya Soman, an expert on constitutional law, said the court has been overly deferential to Trump on many immigration-related issues. "A defeat for the Republican president on birthright citizenship would be significant in part because the weight of argument and precedent is strongly on one side here, more so than in most of the other cases," Soman said. Though the court has frequently sided with Trump over the past year on immigration matters and beyond, the arguments potentially foreshadow a major blow to another signature priority for the president. The justices, in a 6-3 ruling in February, struck down the sweeping global tariffs that Trump pursued under a law meant for use in national emergencies. That ruling provoked Trump to lash out at the court, calling the justices who ruled against him unpatriotic and disloyal, and two of his appointees, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, an embarrassment to their families. The Supreme Court's not been acting very well, Trump said on Wednesday, adding that certain justices he appointed want to show their independence. Stupid people, he called them. The fact that Trump was present in the elegant courtroom is unlikely to make a difference in the outcome of the case. A ruling is expected by the end of June. As he watched the proceedings, however, Trump might have spotted a marble frieze above the bench where the justices preside in their black robes. One of the sculpted figures depicted, with a book at his side, is known as Majesty of the Law. Trump has discussed firing Attorney General Bondi, media reports say. By Reuters. Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump has discussed firing Attorney General Pam Bondi amid his frustration with her leadership, including what he sees as a lack of aggression in targeting his enemies and over her handling of the Epstein files, the New York Times reported on Wednesday. Trump has floated the idea of replacing Bondi with Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lee Zeldin, the report said, citing four unnamed sources familiar with the conversations. CNN also reported the discussions. The White House did not respond to a request for comment by Reuters. The Justice Department also did not immediately respond. In a statement to the New York Times, Trump said, "Attorney General Pam Bondi is a wonderful person and she is doing a good job." A spokesman for Bondi referred to Trump's statement, the Times said. Bondi was at the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday as the Republican president attended oral arguments on a birthright citizenship case. Critics say Trump has dispensed with decades-long norms designed to insulate federal law enforcement from political pressures. He campaigned for the presidency vowing retribution after facing a slew of legal woes once his first term in the White House ended in 2021. He has continued to publicly call out his perceived adversaries and has pushed Bondi's Justice Department to bring charges against them. Since Trump took office a second time in January 2025, federal prosecutors have targeted former FBI Director James Comey, New York Attorney General Letitia James, Federal Reserve Board Governor Lisa Cook, and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The White House has said Trump is abiding by his campaign promises to restore a justice system that he accuses of being weaponized by his Democratic predecessor, Joe Biden. The investigative files on the late convicted sex criminal Jeffrey Epstein have also dogged Bondi, with a congressional panel issuing a subpoena for her to testify in its related investigation. Bondi, a former Florida state attorney general, represented Trump during his first impeachment trial in his first White House term. She was Trump's second pick for the top U.S. law enforcement job after his first choice, former U.S. Representative Matt Gaetz, withdrew his name from consideration ahead of a congressional ethics report that found he had paid women for sex and drugs and obstructed Congress. U.S. labor market remains stable. Trade deficit widens in February. By Lucia Muticani, Washington. New applications for U.S. unemployment benefits unexpectedly fell last week amid low layoffs, suggesting labor market conditions remained calm in March, though economists warned that a prolonged war in the Middle East posed a downside risk. The month-long U.S.-Israeli war with Iran has added another layer of uncertainty for businesses, which were trying to navigate a forever-shifting trade policy. The war has sent global oil prices soaring more than 50%. The national average retail gasoline price this week topped $4 a gallon for the first time in more than 3 years. Higher energy costs would slow consumer spending and increase costs for business and further restrain hiring, economists warned. President Donald Trump on Wednesday vowed more aggressive strikes on Iran. "We expect weaker job growth and a higher unemployment rate for 2026 than we had been forecasting prior to the war," said Nancy van der Houten, lead U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, but the war's impact on the labor market will take a bit more time to materialize. Initial claims for state unemployment benefits dropped 9,000 to a seasonally adjusted 202,000 for the week ended March 28, the Labor Department said on Thursday. Economists polled by Reuters had forecast 212,000 claims for the latest week. Claims have moved in a 201,000 to 230,000 range this year, consistent with what economists describe as a low-hire, low-fire labor market. They have blamed the labor market stagnation on lingering uncertainty caused by Trump's aggressive import tariffs. Growth in private, non-farm payrolls has averaged just 18,000 jobs per month in the 3 months through February. Reduced labor supply because of the Trump administration's hardline immigration policy was also hampering job growth, economists said. The claims report has no bearing on the closely watched employment report for March, as it falls outside the survey periods. Non-farm payrolls likely rebounded by 60,000, a Reuters survey of economists showed. Payrolls dropped by 92,000 jobs in February, partly because of a strike by healthcare workers and harsh weather. The employment rate is forecast to have held steady at 4.4% in March. The Bureau of Labor Statistics will release March's employment report on Friday. Good Friday is not a federal holiday in the United States, though some financial markets are closed. The number of people receiving unemployment benefits after an initial week of aid, a proxy for hiring, increased 25,000 to a seasonally adjusted 1.841 million during the week ending March 21, the claims report showed. The so-called continuing claims have declined from last year's lofty levels, but people exhausting their eligibility for benefits, limited to 26 weeks in most states, could be holding the number down. BLS data this week showed a larger-than-expected drop in job openings in February and hiring falling to the lowest level in nearly 6 years. U.S. stocks opened lower. The dollar gained versus a basket of currencies. U.S. Treasury yields rose. That concludes this Thursday's reading from Reuters. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.